CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 139, with Dr. Abhay Vasavada, an amazing pioneer and professor who has taught us so much over the last many years. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today, I've got a very special guest, my guru, my professor for three decades, that is Dr. Abhay Vasavada. Professor Abhay, welcome to our podcast. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for the opportunity, Uday. I'm really feel honored, and it's a pleasure to be on your Cataract Coach.
Now, you know, I first heard your name when I was a resident, and I had a posterior polar cataract. I saw a paper of yours in 1990s, 30 years ago, about posterior polar cataract, and I thought it was brilliant. But it scared me. It says like 30% complication rate.
More than that.
I couldn't believe it. Now, how did you become so prolific in ophthalmology? You've done so much.
Well, you know, I must say I'm blessed with a team. All along my career, I had wonderful people supporting me, working for me and with me. So I really benefited more from my fellows and juniors than they did.
Right.
And posterior polar is one of the examples of that evolution for myself. As you said, I reported 33% posterior capsule rupture in those days.
Tell me, how did you learn this? So your fellows were helping you with this?
Yes, you know, we were discussing afterwards and before the next case, what is happening, why we are rupturing and so on. But I must give credit before I say anything for myself to Dr. Bobby Osher, who really has clarified some of the concepts for all of us. And I picked many of them, and I modified a little bit in my hands. And slowly we realized. And one of the things we realized was that the cushion effect has to be there when you try to remove the central lens material. And conventional delineation didn't work consistently or predictably in my hand, because sometimes it would go, the fluid goes subcapsular in the wrong plane and ruptures, hydroruptures. So we innovated a technique we called inside-out delineation, where we did not perform any hydro procedure. Straight away, after axis, we create the sculpting maneuvers and create a trench with a decent wall in each side. And then with a right-angle cannula, we could titrate the depth of the cushion we want to create by injecting in the right plane. So that really reduced the chance of that fluid going in the subcapsular plane and inadvertent hydrorupture. So that we found very good. And with that, our results came down to about 10% or 12%. I don't remember now, but sort of drastic change we noticed. And later on in last, I don't know, maybe 10 years now, that we are using the flex technique as our first choice. Delineating with the laser technology is even more precise and have multiple cushion effect. And therefore, when you remove one internal core of the material, the other ones are protecting. So one by one, we can remove that delineated or demarcated sheet of lens material. So that improved, and now I believe our rate we reported was less than 4% or about 4%. So that's where we stand today. But I tell you, many times what I hear, and I sometimes was doing myself, was that some of the posterior subcapsular cataract, which are plaque cataract, which they look like a posterior polar actually, because they are fairly demarcated. We believe it's a posterior polar, but nothing happens. So many of these so-called posterior polar are not true posterior polar cataracts. So what is a true posterior polar cataract? I think it's a, first of all, punched out or very demarcated central opacity. Right. It may be a little bit eccentric. That's an issue. But Typically, it has a bull's eye, what my senior colleague, late Dr. Daljit Singh, described as onion sign, kind of a whorls or a bull's eye appearance. That's very typical, and the central portion of that whorls could be very thin, or it could be very adherent to the posterior capsule. And that's the way sometimes, even after removing the nucleus, when we try to remove that final epinucleus plate, it ruptures at times because of that central area within that bull's area being adherent or fragile with the fluidics, it ruptures. So, you know, posterior polar has been very interesting situation.
For sure. Now, when I see the posterior polar in the pre-op consultation of the slit lamp, one of my tricks is to put the red reflex, and like you said, look for a very clean demarcation. Like a posterior subcapsule will kind of like feather out, whereas the posterior polar is kind of like a hard edge. Is there any other pearls you can give us in the pre-op where we can determine, is it polar, is it PSC?
Well, as you said, that is the very, very important sign, but also the age of the patient. Because sometimes the person comes in their late 50s or early 60s with some nuclear sclerosis in anterior to that, and then it's not easy. And if I ask the history and all the stuff, they never had a problem until late 30s or so. So, and then if it is not demarcated or a central area is not very kind of island kind of stuff, I think it's not a posterior polar. So, but counseling is the most important. Even if you in your heart believe it's not going to rupture or not a posterior polar, we tell and warn the patients of the possibility. And I bring their younger ones or the relatives or parents or whatever that, you know, this is a possibility. What happens sometimes is that the patient comes alone or with somebody, and the post-op, when it doesn't go well, some new faces appear on the scene with the patient's relative. And I just want to make sure that I really, so in a posterior polar or wherever I have a complicated or a challenging case, I make a point that as many members of the family comes to me as a second visit, purely for counseling, so that I hammer them, I make sure the disease they have, make them aware, and so on. So I think nothing more than what you said, actually.
So that's a good point. If you predict the problem ahead of time, you're a very smart doctor. But if you don't tell them about the potential problem and then it happens, now you're a bad guy.
Yeah, nobody will buy your story now, then, you see.
That's a very smart point. Now, the other thing is, you treat it like the nucleus of the lens. You treat it like an onion then.
Yes.
So you want to go appropriate layers. So you're using now the femtosecond laser to choose appropriate layers to dissect down to keep a bit of a cushion.
Yeah.
What do you program in the laser? What are you doing?
No, what happens is that we need, not all the laser machines have these kind of patterns. Most of them all have the chop pattern or some other thing. This one I have, and probably one or two other machines may have the same thing. You have a rings, you can put it as a thing, and they do a vertical sharp cut so that it's very easy to remove the very central and then the paracentral and the last peripheral thing because of the smooth edges that the laser did. It's easy to go with a chopper or some instrument and bring it out, like shackle it out and fit it to the phaco probe. Phaco probe doesn't change that peripheral wall. It just remains in the center. They are fed with that shell technique, shelling out for that. And it's so easy with that sharp cut thing. So that's one thing. And we need, when the final epinucleus plate remains, still it can rupture. So what I do, and Dr. Bobby also calls it in a different name, what I say is that we need to establish a communication between the posterior compartment, the critical compartment between the posterior capsule and the remaining fine epinucleus and the anterior chamber. And how do we do that? So I detach the epinucleus at 2-3 clock hours facing me if I'm sitting temporal nasal part. So the fluid goes in that and there is a communication established. So the pressure, there is no risk of sudden buildup of hydraulic pressure. And then I sometimes just buy manual IA and have an access to the remaining epinucleus, which is still attached to the
right.
Or I twist my phaco probe, which I generally don't recommend, and detach few clock hours more at the epinucleus. But that's establishing and balancing the fluid pressure by creating some communication between the final anterior chamber and that one. I think it's very important also.
What about doing a dispersive viscoelastic and maybe a little visco dissection to get the last bit of epinuclear shell and cortex off the bag?
I think that's a very good technique. And if I remember correctly, Dr. McCool described that viscote or a chondroitin sulfate hydrodissection in many situations, including this one. And it works. I tried it. I didn't work as well or predictably in my hand. But I think that's a great idea. There's nothing, you know.
And then another surprise in posterior polar, which I've seen a video. Well, you think you're done and you clean up the bag. The bag is nice and beautiful and clean. And then the surgeon pulls out of the eye, AC collapses, the bag comes forward and splits right down the middle. So never let the bag collapse, right?
I have two of these cases, and I keep showing this in various meetings. But I must say, and once again, there is a surgeon in Brazil, Centurio, Virgilio Centurio. He described, I saw it first time, him many, many years ago. And then one of my patients where I was finished, I implant viscoelastic removed, and my theater assistant were packing up the trolley, and I just hydrated the side port.
Okay.
And the direction of the side port hydration has to be, everywhere you hydrate the incision, by the way, has to be in a particular direction. You don't want to go in and detach the decimates and so on. So, but whatever, I hydrated it, and maybe, you know, I was also relaxed, adrenaline rush over. And that time, the entire posterior capsule ruptured.
Ooh.
And the question is, what to do then?
Right.
Well, we thought of it, and we decided that let's keep this evil here rather than discovering something new. So we kept it there, and luckily for us, the IOL remained put, no rotation or nothing. And as always, this lens would be either a toric lens or a multifocal when you rupture. It's a rule of, you know, or the other eye where the first eye has been done by Uday or somebody beautiful, and you end up doing the second eye and you rupture. So, but this is, luckily it's not that common. But
right.
In a collapsible group, why it happens probably is that when the eyeball is compliant, when the rigidity of the supporting wall is low, so lower, and suddenly you inflate, like we see in the cataract surgery in high myopes, inflation and deflation, so common. Mm-hmm. So that sort of eye is more vulnerable, but I don't know. Maybe it would, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. Important lessons learned. Sometimes, like you said, we learn the hard way. If the capsule breaks, chances are it's going to be a multifocal or toric lens that have to go in the bag, and now stuck.
Yes. Yes. So true. So common, so familiar.
I mean, that's why, you know, cataract surgery, I'm sure you'll agree, after so many decades and tens of thousands of cases, is so rewarding, but yet still so humbling. We've got to be so cautious every case.
You know, this reminds me of my friend who is a brilliant cataract surgeon in my city, Ahmedabad. And he's more or less my age, and he's really the top class. But he said, I get bored, and he retired few years ago. You say it's so monotonous, one after another. But I said, I totally disagree with you. Every time I do a cataract surgery, although I know that, you know, most of the time I will be done and nice, but we never know, actually. So I think cataract surgery is one of the surgeries in medicine, probably, that is so rewarding. But on the other hand, it's always an exciting, and a perfection is something that we want to get better and better every time we operate. And there will always be some little spot, whether it's a wash of the eye, or putting speculum, or covering the lids, and hydrodissection all throughout the procedure. There will be something you may not be doing perfect, and you say, next time I want to improve on that.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of.
Terrific.
Cataract
I heard a beautiful quote. The quote was, cataract surgery takes many years to learn, but truly a lifetime to master.
I know. Great. I think so. I don't think we'll ever be able to do that, because there is so many little details and, you know, devil lies in details. So I think it's just really, so I'm really thrilled. Every time I sit on the chair, I want to look into the microscope. I change my PD, which has been set for me always, but I refix it, make sure I have a fresh look. And this is my friend. I want to help him. How do I do this? So I sit there, and then I proceed. Every time I do the cataract.
Oh, I do the same thing. In my operating room also, the staff sets it up, puts some dials in my PD, but I always go there early. I like to adjust the focus on my own.
Yes, yes,
I always
yes.
make sure the camera is in focus. I always do a white balance. I always clean the camera, the microscope lenses myself to make sure there's no marks on them. It's funny. I do the same thing.
Yeah. I think we are all kind of had our fixed routine or reflexes, but I think it's very good. And overall, I think it's a good thing to have some, whatever the plan and you have, it's good to follow it every time.
Yeah, no, for sure. Now, besides posterior polar, I also learned a lot from you when I was doing a lot of pediatric cases. You have a huge amount of experience in pediatric cataract surgery.
Well, unfortunately, we are blessed with these cataracts in children in my part of the world. And there are two issues. One is that they come quite late. In other words, if they don't come in first 1 month or 2 months, they come after 6 months or a year or something like that, when the mother notices the white spot in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something we are trying to educate for many years, and we are improving slowly and slowly. So my major problem is that we do a good surgery and everything, but, you know, I wish that come a little earlier. But the key is the support of the parents. I mean, we need a team like any other procedure or management. But in here, in addition to the anesthetist and the pediatric coordinator, the most important members are the parents themselves. Because parents have to understand that this is not one of those cataracts that their in-laws or parents have and
right.
have no glasses. This is... The reason we are operating cataract in children is not to make them glasses free. We are operating is because we want to improve the vision in that eye and vision binocularly. And that's very difficult for the parents who come from, majority of our parents who come from the lower socioeconomic background and so on. So I think counseling and taking parents with us is very important. Second
right.
thing, if we really want to take a pediatric cataract, is the coordinator. What we do is we need to have a follow-up. What happens is that being a tertiary kind of center for pediatric cataract, we get patients from far away places. So we support their travel, feed them when they come, give little gifts to children. But we want to make sure that they come whenever we ask them to come for follow-up. Because then and then we will improve and find out what has happened to them. It's okay in the first few days, all will look nice. But later on, they develop this fibrosis, the capsule, the decentration, inflammation, and so on. They don't carry out the occlusion. And so I think.
Amblyopia, yeah.
Yeah. So the surgeon plays an important role in the overall management, but more important role is not the surgeon, because most of the cataract surgeons who decide to take this are okay. But the other part, the support, the parent, the coordinator, bringing them, giving, that is very important for amblyopia and getting a functional outcome. But pediatric cataract is still not, we don't know what is the power that we should be putting in that particular age. Because everybody has some kind of a clinical formulae, which is not really precise as we have
right.
in adults. So that's
right.
one major issue with that. And still, under 6 months of age, when we operate children under infants under 6 months, the tissues are not mature. The uveal tissue is the one which is really the culprit, because the blood aqueous barrier, the pigments and the iris tissue, the uveal tissue in general, trabecular meshwork endothelium, mesodermal dyssynostosis, all of these really are factors which can produce sometimes horrendous inflammatory response. But with improved understanding of the cataract surgery, and most of the principles are we have translated from the adult cataract surgery, like closed chamber technique, no touch, no fluttering of the iris. Obviously, mechanical trauma is little, but even little collapsing iris deliberate the mediator so much in children. So we need to be absolutely very critical and watchful about the iris tissue. Many of these pupils don't dilate. They have these membranes and sort of things. So, but overall, as we progress, and Marshall Park in the 80s introduced this concept that we should do capsulectomy in the posterior capsule. And then first time we produced an evidence in the literature that along with the anterior vitrectomy, which was a part of the procedure at that time, it does help reproduce an evidence in a randomized way in early 90s. So anterior vitrectomy, the way we open up the capsule now, and vitrectomy now with the limbal or a pars plana, making sure with Triumph cinnolone injection at the end and so on, has produced a fairly decent outcome as a rule. But some children, and particularly under 6 month glaucoma, is one of the issues which we are in a manuscript at the moment. 20% of the eyes, in spite of whatever I say and whatever we talk, have a raised IOP which needs some medical treatment if the child is under 6 months. So operating 20% under 6 months, I would recommend that first, if you want to take up, if any cataract surgeon wants to take up, build up a team, first of all. Good anesthetist, because IOP will go up if you're not using the right technique of anesthesia, gases, and all these other things. And then take an older child, say 5 years plus, then work your age down as you get some more experience. But try, think 100 times before you take up an infant, particularly if it is less than 6 months. Because in the best of the best, and also these eyes are not developed in a gross, a simple language as well as we should. So the response is different. The barrier, the mediators, the fibrosis, the epithelial cells, lens epithelial cells are so powerful in our eyes, as we know, but more so in children. So they react and they produce epithelial mesenchymal transformation, the fibrosis. And then decentered and visual axis obscuration and so on. So I think it's a speciality on its own, and I feel it should be taken up by a surgeon who has a good team, who understand the cataract surgery principles very well, has mastered the cataract surgery in general, and so on. The pediatric ophthalmologists in America and other things, they are very good because they are doing only that, and they have also learned over the years. So that's a different group of individuals. But in general, out of internationally speaking, the trend is that most of the cataract surgeons end up doing pediatric cataract surgery because removing the soft lens is not a big deal, they think. But paying attention to all these and in a small children, it makes a difference. So, it's a specialty. It has its own challenges.
Well, I think you made an important point. These young patients, especially the infants, they're not little adults. It's entirely different. Different. And then the surgery is merely one part of a very long journey. And you said one out of five, 20% may have an increased IOP. They're going to get fibrosis later. They're going to get PCO. There'll be other issues to deal with along the way. And then probably the most important of all is occlusion therapy, treatment for prevention of amblyopia. Yeah. This is, and especially when they're young, constantly changing refractive error as the eye grows.
Yes.
So the surgery, while we love the surgery, that is probably a small part of the whole equation.
Absolutely. Well said. Yeah. I think, that's why we need a follow-up and do all the tricks you can to make sure that they come back for, checking IOP. taking vision in these small children. It's an art. It needs a lot of patience. So we have a devoted optometrist who are specialists, so-called specialists, in dealing with children.
Right.
Because the moment they try to put a frame on the front of the child, yeah, child will not allow it, and so on. Yeah. And amblyopia. So the toys and the games, and it's a different ball game in some sense. But it's a joy. The best part is it's really so satisfying to see a smile on the mother when they come for the follow-up, because she knows the improvement in her, you know, child. Mm-hmm. So that's a tremendous satisfaction.
Yeah, I think we're here in the U.S. a little bit lucky because we have dedicated pediatric ophthalmologists. We even have someone on our podcast. We had Ken Nischel from Pittsburgh who, you know, is like an amazing pediatric ophthalmologist doing everything with baby cataracts, baby lensectomy.
Yes.
But on top of that, in the U.S., I think, certainly in California, all babies at time of birth are screened by the pediatrician to make sure they have a normal red reflex. It's part of there's a checklist of things that are screened at birth. One of them is bilateral red reflex. It's normal.
Yeah. I think that's very important. I'm trying to plead and talk to the ministers involved, but I still have to wait. I don't know how long. But first time I heard was in Sweden, 20 years, 30 years ago. Sweden, it was a compulsory, and they have a registry of the patients. They don't have a name. Oh. Each person in Sweden is always registered by a number. And the mother is not allowed after delivering the baby until the ophthalmologist puts that in the registry. So I think that is so basic, and we should have it. But, you know, logistics and mindset of the planners, I think education is the key. No education
definitely, definitely some challenges there. And you also made a good point that around the world, most pediatric cataract surgery is actually done by just cataract surgeons, not pediatric ophthalmologists.
Yeah, we don't have this pediatric ophthalmology specialty. We never had for many years. In the last 10 years or so, it's increasing. But most of these also end up doing squints, ptosis, and many other procedures. Not every pediatric ophthalmologist is trained or is confident to manage the cataract component of it. But surely it's increasing. And that's how it should be, in my opinion. Yeah.
Now, tell me a little bit more about, you have a very large eye center there, the Raghudeep Eye Hospital. You have a big research center as well. Tell us about this and about what opportunities they have if you have a young ophthalmologist listening who wants to come do fellowship training.
Well, I'm responsible for Raghudeep Eye Hospital, which is like any other hospital. We started focusing only on the cataract. I was trained in England, and I did plenty of detachment, ptosis, and you name it, everything, squints. Yeah. But then 2 years later down the line, I decided to focus, and I was the first cataract specialist in India, where everybody was doing cataract in 84 or 5. And then we developed as a cataract center, and then we put in all other retina glaucoma expert and so on. And I started fellowship in 89. Wow. And by now, fellowship started with 3 months, and then 6 months, a year, 2 years. So at the moment, it's a year and a half. I've trained about 80 international fellows who stayed with me for at least 6 months from different parts of the world, South America, Europe, and whatever else, and more than 200 Indian ophthalmologist fellowship.
Wow.
But then in early 90s, I started a research center, which is recognized by our central government. And this is only research center, eye research center in Western India, who is recognized. And we do quite a bit of research and has produced a lot of publications. At the moment, my thrust is on a genetic studies, and we publish 2-3 genetics studies in cataracts in children. But recently we produced part one of the Dedbeck syndrome genetics.
And
part two of genetics of Dedbeck is under review process at the moment. So genetics is the moment is my top thing. And second thing is the diabetic eye disease, retinopathy in particular. And we want to do a population-based genetic study. Because some patients, in spite of a so-called normal lifestyle or a reasonable lifestyle, they develop diabetes, and we want to target those individuals. What are my chances of developing diabetes, a patient in 50s and 60s? So we want to do some large-scale genetic thing, and we are just formulating. It's quite difficult, but that sort of thing we are doing. So I'm excited in the research. Myself, personally, I'm sort of semi-retired now. I'll be 75 in 2 weeks' time.
Happy birthday.
All right, thanks. And so I'm operating still, particularly children and these dead bags and many others. But I'm shifting my energy more in the research and the projects which with the society or a population at large can be impacted. You know,
that's fantastic. Yeah, I often say, after a certain age, I'm going to change my specialty to cataracts with 8 millimeter dilation and only 2+ nuclear sclerosis. Yes, everything else, I'll give to the young surgeons.
Yeah, that's what I dream when I have a black cataract operation. And the following day, when I go to sleep, I say, I wish I had that and not this one. So true, isn't it?
You got to give it to the young dog. Now, let's talk a little bit about dead bag syndrome. Now, this is kind of a big mystery for a lot of people. We've seen this where the bag is crystal clear, but no fibrosis. And it's again, it's a dead bag. Why does this happen? I don't know.
I don't think anybody knows this. It's really, truly an enigma, actually. And if we just go back a little, the late decentration of IOL occurring a few years later can occur because of the support system getting less. So entire bag gets decentered or malpositioned. And that's primarily because of the zonulopathy.
So like pseudo-exfoliation.
Like pseudo-exfoliation, myopia, retinitis, pigmentosa, uveitis. But where truly it's not the IOL, but the bag dislocates and bag contains the IOL. So bag dislocation containing IOL is the very common and well-researched in the literature. Okay. But the second way the IOL decentered is that, as you mentioned, the capsular bag is in situ. It's in exactly the same position it has always been. The zonules are intact. No zonular weakness or deficiency. Anterior capsule, the rexus is well-centered. But the posterior capsule, the floor of the bag, ruptures. And then the IOL gets decentered and sometimes dislocates completely into the vitreous. So why the posterior capsule ruptures or breaks or becomes fragile, we don't know. But the theory is that the lens epithelial cells at the equator don't function well. Now, on the physiology aspect, nobody knows even today what maintains the health and integrity of our posterior capsule, even in aphakic eyes.
Yeah. Or
the anterior capsule has an epithelium on it. So the belief is that the lens epithelial cells at the equator gives perfusion and all the maintains the health. And these lens epithelial cells somehow in that individual doesn't work. They gradually shrink. They are either absent or very scanty. And therefore, the posterior capsule doesn't survive. My additional hypothesis is that addition to the lens epithelial cells, there may be some changes occurring in anterior vitreous because posterior capsule on one hand is exposed to the epithelial cells and lens material and IOL. On the other side is anterior vitreous. And we don't understand very much. We now know that like PVD, anterior vitreous face detaches. We also know that in high myope, when these vitreous liquefaction or anterior vitreous detachment occur, there is increased risk of nuclear cataracts and glaucoma. And I believe it's primarily because of the vitreous. Nobody knows it, but this is my personal hypothesis, and we are working on it. So whatever the reason why the posterior capsule ruptures, there are 2-3 distinct possibilities, but it seems that lens epithelial cell remains a major contributing non-functioning lens epithelial cells is a major reason. But inherent posterocapsular genetic defects, as we suggested in part one publication, and we don't know whether anti-vitreous phase has any role. We are just exploring.
Interesting.
So it is really enigma, but what has changed the clinician is, you know, we all know this. When the patient comes for a cataract, typically they ask, is this lens going to last forever, doctor? Do I need a replacement of this lens? Because they hear YAG laser and things like that. So I confidently have reassured them over the years. No, this lens outlasts you. Don't worry, it will remain there. I'll change that tone now when the patient.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm honestly speaking, because I'll tell you why. And I now tell that, yes, typically it will outlast you, but very, very rarely it can decenter after many, many years. We don't know. So what you should do is to keep coming to me every 2, 3 years, 5 years, even if you do not have symptoms, because we are reporting the case sequence of a case where it was stable lens, no intact capsule, a ruptured capsule, intact, stable IOL, and 2 years later, that stable IOL with that rupture with development subluxated. So the point is that we need to counsel the patient the importance of remaining under follow-up for lifelong.
Yeah.
That I've learned, and I'm preaching that to our colleagues, that remember, because I've been embarrassed a few times already by now, you know, and I have the largest series in the world of dead back syndrome cases, because people have found out that this is a dumping yard. Let's give them a garbage collection. So we are getting a lot of this now. And this is the thing. So dead back is really, it's, and I believe, although the IOL material is at the moment doesn't appear to be a factor, in other words, hydrophobic versus hydrophilic, and PMMN, and whatever else, I don't know. Maybe that there is more than one reason why this ruptures, you know, I'm sure. So maybe if the material is found to be the reason down the line, the industry may have to change the material. I don't know. And how frequent it is going to be. And I believe it is geography dependent. In America, in USA, it is quite seen of reasonable frequency. In our part, very much. In Europe, I was given an oration last year in Germany, and I gave this dead back stuff. And Thomas Neuhand and quite a few friends came and said, I've seen one case. Now that you say, I just remember I had one case, but they don't see many. At least not yet. So I don't know whether it's something to do with the genetics, ethnic, or whatever. But so it's very interesting disease that we are discovering. And credit goes to Dr. Sam Maskett coining the right word.
Yeah.
And we all, Sam Maskett and I and a few others, have been teaching this late dislocation. And I used to call this entity as a spontaneous rupture of the capsule, and that, but never gave a name to it. And Sam also did the same. He also never did. So finally, he coined this term, dead back syndrome. And it's a very smart name. It's a very good name. Although biologically speaking, purely from cell biologist, I have a cell biologist with me. He said it's truly not a dead because there is some biological activity in the back, but that's not, it doesn't, it's irrelevant to us. So Dr. Maskett really very nicely coined this term and gave recognition of this entity, which many of the surgeons all over the world have noticed it, but never actually realized that this is distinct from the zonulopathy bag dislocation.
Is it related to capsule bag polishing? Is there a benefit, by the way, of capsule bag polishing? Should we polish the bag?
No, I don't think there is any benefit, because we did, many have done. There is a controversy, but we ourselves with Bharti Nihalani, we published a paper where half the capsule was scraped and half was not scraped.
Okay.
You see, in the same eye. So no other confounding influence. And it was good for 2, 3, 4 months. The capsule was clear on this. But at 6 months, everything was same. And when we scrape, whatever mechanisms we have, chemical or mechanical, you cannot scrape the culprit ellie cells, which are located in that germinative zone
at the equator.
There is no way in the world you can remove that. So this is, and there are studies which have shown, and all of this, I stopped scraping many years, and I have, of my total cases, 45% of cases are my own operating.
Wow.
They come after 10 years, 15 years, they were so happy, and, you know, and 55 are from others, but I never scraped the capsule, anti-capsule.
Well, I think what you said also is important, the follow-up for patients, because we make some pseudophakic at age 60, 70, whatever. But even if the capsule stays fine and the bag is fine and the lens is fine, the incidence of macular degeneration and glaucoma increases dramatically with age.
Yeah. I think we don't understand all this biology and physiology of the vitreous, the endothelial of the trabecular meshwork, the barriers, and so on. Like as we see on our outwardly skin and a face and a body, everything has to age.
Yes.
It's only that, you know, and therefore the function. I can't sprint now. I jog, but I can't sprint. I used to. Like that, you see. So I think it is quite natural to have these things occurring and piling up eventually.
Yeah, there's no, that's for sure. There's no escaping age. I mean,
one of the
interesting things I did with my father before he passed away last year was we compared the same flashlight we shine in the eye for the exact 10 seconds, and we see for me, for my father at age 85, for me at age 50-something, for my son at age 20-something, how fast do you recover the vision? And boy, in a 20-year-old, you shine the flashlight there for 10 seconds to wipe out the vision. You recover it in 1 second.
Yes.
When you're in your 50s, a few seconds. When you're 85, it took my dad like 20 seconds.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very smart way that you elicited that dark adaptation or light recovery adaptation.
Your light recovery.
Yeah, you know. But this is we see this in our life without recognizing this as this event, you know.
Right.
In the evening times, the steps stepping down, or in the road which is not familiar, we sort of slow down a little. It's very interesting.
I mean, one of the challenges I have in my practice here in Los Angeles, especially at the Beverly Hills patients, is expectation in an 80-year-old to see like a 20-year-old. And I said, come on, give me a break.
I know, unfortunately, the U.S., I call Americanization in our part of the world, is spreading, and most of these is something which the better part is not coming here. This kind of thing is so common now, and in big cities, and my patients like yours are also coming from that kind of a mindset, and because they can afford, they can pay everything, and so on, that they think they can buy this, you know.
Right. very, very funny. Listen, we've been talking for 45 minutes. We have about 15 minutes left. I want to ask your advice. Now, you've been an ophthalmologist for about 50 years, which is an incredible career. You've had such a worldwide impact. Obviously, you've achieved all these awards at the business society, but even more importantly, you're so sweet. Even more importantly, though, there are so many thousands of ophthalmologists like me who look up to you as, like, seriously, a guru, role model. What advice would you give? Our podcast, there are a lot of 30-something-year-old ophthalmologists in the 30s and 40s who are beginning of their career, and they love the podcast, they listen to it, they want some great advice. How can they be more successful in their careers? What's the secret here?
Well, I don't know whether there is any secret, but I think it's the basics. First of all, as a human being, you need to be very honest to yourself and why you are doing it. A patient sitting in front of you on the other side of slit lamp could be yourself. So when you examine the way you would have been like to be examined, advise that way, investigate and operate that way. So that's fundamental, is very important. It's sort of in this modern practice style, it sometimes is lost, or it goes in the background, because we see a patient coming, entering for consultation, whether it's a refractive cataract surgery or a true cataract surgery, we see the benefits and commercial gain and so on. So we sometimes forget, and we get carried away suggesting something which we would not have done ourselves.
Right.
So that's fundamental, and because we invest, we are ambitious, and everybody wants to be as famous and as rich as Dr. Uday Devgan. They want to be very quick. They don't have a patience. So all of these guys who are well known have sweated. They had sleepless nights, and
right.
It was so hard that they don't know, or very few people know this. So I think second thing is that this is a hard work. For getting any excellence or a perfection or mastering something, it's a long process, lead a lot of hard work, patience, and guidance and direction. So if you are trained in an institute where you think you didn't have that much, or even if you had, you wanted to excel, you need to visit few persons whom you think are good people. And I spent time with quite a few individuals in different countries when I was evolving. And you learn not only the surgical part, but how they talk to the patient, how they behave themselves, how humble they are, and so on. So I think for young people, this would be no sense. What are you saying? Whatever I tell to my grandson, he doesn't listen to me. He's done stuck there. So that's something philosophical. But having said that, I think you need to have a fellowship, number one, or a devoted focused training in a specialty that you want to do, cataract, for example.
Sure.
Second thing, have an access to cataract coach and many other these kind of educational activities that you can have an access to and do that. Only catch is that you can be misguided by some speakers or some platform. So you need to be a little bit careful. Always discuss with your colleague, interacting. Be honest and interact. In the evening, I used to phone my other competitor in the town that Shrenik, I ruptured it, you know, and he would ask, what did you do? And we interact if we can improve or discuss with the team members. So plan it well beforehand and discuss with your friend. Many of my fellows ring me on the previous day that, sir, I'm operating this one. What's your final advice, Steve? What's the score? And so on. So I think be in touch with your friends or anyone whom you think you can take a reliable advice and be patient. Your day will come. If I could do it, you would be able to do much better now with the access to this digital technology, internet, and so much of this teaching. And on that point, I strongly recommend cataract coach because I've seen, this is my first time, but I saw a couple of your cataract coach, excellent educational platform. And I wish I had listened to this earlier. I would have been a better surgeon, Uday, I must tell you.
You're too sweet.
No. So the point is that whatever the video, the VAT labs and whatever you have, but be patient and be kind and be honest to the patient. If you cannot manage your thing in your heart, pass it on to other friends,
right,
even if he's your competitor. Don't have an ego issue because you're doing, why are you doing it? Only the patient is at your heart. So do whatever you do or not do, keeping patients at the core or center of it. And I think this is a common sense. Don't chase anything. The things will come to you automatically. The money, the glamour, and the patience will follow. And mouth to mouth, it still is the best thing. Even if you have this all the marketing devices and tricks and platforms, mouth to mouth, a happy patient is something is worth having. One happy patient is enough to start, you know?
Right. No, for sure. Word of mouth, even now, is my most important thing for my practice success. But yeah, I also believe in the one rule, like you said. The one rule is I give every patient the same high level of care that I want from my own eyes.
Correct.
100% of the time. And that's what I would teach my residents when I taught for 20 years. Yeah, give every patient the same treatment that you want to receive.
Yeah. And in we have a little unique situation at my practice, in children particularly, and some posterior polar are complicated. Many of these patients cannot afford my consultation also. Forget about the surgical charges, because they come from a really low strata. So I don't even ask them. I instruct them not to charge them, nothing. So we do that kind of a charity. And when we operate, we do not compromise. Just because I'm not benefiting anything, I will not do any. I will use the same quality viscoelastic, same IOL, same instrumentation, change cassette every time, and so on. So no compromise. So that is not easy, and that I would not recommend for a young person. I mean, you need to earn, of course. But be considerate to the local. That our part faces more than the Western world, you know?
Right. No, those are very important issues there, for sure. But I mean, all things to consider, I think it's still an amazing time to be an ophthalmologist. I think what you were saying earlier is that the resources available. I mean, for me, 30 years ago, I was, anytime I could find one of Bobby Osher's videotapes, my eyes lit up. I went home and watched it again and again and again. But now on your mobile phone, you have the entire library of everything ophthalmic. Everything.
Yeah. I think to be in touch or exposed to a good teacher is your luck, or is that you should try to do. And as you mentioned, Dr. Osher, I sat in his course on the floor because the courses were jam-packed. So I would sit on the floor and listen to him and few others as well. But that sort of your own desire to excel or to improve, it comes from within. And you will get, if you taste a success, one patient or one good procedure, you will get boost, confident, energy to do more and better and better. So I think this is very interesting. And for me, the journey has been, you know, I was trained with Grafys knife.
My
ophthalmology residency in Baroda, 71 to 74. And I left hand graphy, right hand graphy, intracapsular, one suture, and broad iridectomy. Then I went to England, still intracapsular. They were quite backward. But last year of my 6 years or plus stint, I learned a little bit of extracapsular. So then I came back and did extracapsular. I didn't have much taste of small incision, non-phaco technique. I changed from ECC to phaco direct in 89. And when I did, I had no clue what kind of cataract I should select. So all my cases were brunescent or black. And I had, in first 20 patients that I did, I had 3 drop nucleus.
Wow.
And the retinal surgeon didn't have this exposure. Until that time, they were not drop nucleus.
Yeah.
So they didn't know how to do this. So I can tell you, honestly, the famous retinal surgeon, a very good surgeon, I still respect him. And I went to his clinic with this patient. And he said, how to do this? So he did some vitrectomy. And then with Vactis or something, we pulled it up. And I removed it when the whole nucleus coming out of the anterior chamber, opened the eye and so on. So this was the level and experience of
wow
thing. And we needed. So now, you know, so that sort of thing is. And then you do this PECO and new machines and several ways and techniques and lasers and whatever. The IOL. So it's just so much fascinating. I still enjoy it. I don't get bored at all.
Yeah, I mean, what an incredible journey you've had. Now, for the young surgeons, I know what a von Grafy knife is. They don't know. Could you explain this in a few sentences?
Well, Grafys knife was developed by von Grafy in Germany. It's a one knife where you introduce at three clock hours and enter the anterior chamber, come out at 9 clock hours and slice it, the entire limbus. So the half of the globe is open. You bend the cornea, double up, so all the folds appear, and you, with the forceps, you grab the capsule, entry capsule, and remove the entire cataract within the bag. So that was the procedure. And we were standing. We would have sometimes a headlight on it. With the tracking people use it at the night when they track. that kind of headlight, we would have it. But being young, I never had a light on it. So we stand on the operating head of the patient. We do this. No sitting concept. No concept of sitting on a chair or a microscope or nothing.
Yeah. Wow, yeah. This is a huge blade that's probably 15 millimeters long. And again, you go into, you sit superiorly with the right eye, you go with your right hand, left eye, you go with your left hand. You start at the temporal limbus, you go all the way across the AC, exit the nasal limbus, and then you cut 180 degrees of the limbus.
Yes.
All the cornea over. Oh my, I've never seen it in person. I've only seen videos. And even the videos were shocking.
I know. Well, I hate to admit that this could be my video also. but the point is that, you know, and we used to do so many cataract surgery in a short time, you know, because just incision, remove the cataract, take one suture, inject air bubble, and 7 out of 10 will have anti-vitreous in the chamber, you know, and the cornea will shine. And we would be very happy that cornea is shining, you see.
different world. And you went through that, and now you end up with?
Yeah.
Small incision phaco, femtosecond late. Yeah. It's a different world, completely different world.
You know, very few people know how hard it has been to adapt and adjust to at a different milestones, you know.
What
but it's, that's the kick. That was the real thing.
Well, it hammers home the point that you better keep teaching yourself, because every year, every few years, things are going to change. And in 10 years, 20 years, what you're doing today is going to be backwards.
Yeah. You know, in England, I was the tutor and lecturing how good the intracapsular is comparing the extracapsular, all the benefits of intracapsular. And I taught in FRCS courses. And I really put my head now. And you see, so many such things that we have done. We condemned it, and we are adapting it, and naming it is a different thing. It's a little modification and so on. But it's the same thing.
Yeah. Wow, yeah. It's amazing. I mean, what a blessing ophthalmology has been kind of to all of us, especially to you. What an amazing career you've had.
Oh, thank you.
And I love that you're still so passionate, and you're still there advancing it, now doing so much more research. And I look forward to seeing more things come out of your research institute.
One thing I can tell you, I'll be here for quite a while. So I assure you, I'll be around for a while, surely.
No, you have so much more work to do. You gotta help us solve more of these mysteries.
Thank you. But so kind. And really, I thank Uday for giving such a wonderful opportunity. You might not know, but I picked up quite a few points already from you. The way you are teaching and bringing out that pulse. Very nice. And keep doing this, cataract coach. The whole world loves this. And
thank you.
There are so many fans out there. Every time I visit a country or thing, oh, do you know Uday? We always listen and look forward for that cataract coach podcast and so on. So thank you for helping the community.
Oh, it's a pleasure. You know, we all learn together. And I promise I learn more than I teach, always.
The same here, you know. We learned more from juniors, actually, because they raised the question and they innocently asked, you know. And one my fellow asked while scrubbing, why our corneas get white at the end, the incision side, at that time? And then we research and we now don't get it, something like that. So this is amazing, learning from others. Yeah.
Well, the young people have a different perspective, which is a fresh perspective, and they ask questions that sometimes I didn't think of.
Yeah.
So fantastic. I mean,
we are noticing it for ages, but we never actually thought about it or questioned it. Yeah.
So it's from what? Hydration?
Yeah. Yeah, from hydration. There was a natural hydration at the end of the surgery because of the distortion of the incisions and the tight incision. And that time, we are using universal one. At that time. So then we realized restricting the movement, don't keep the phaco probe steady, and careful sizing of the incision and heating and so on, you know. And we published a paper on how to reduce that and so on many, many years ago.
So much stuff to learn. Well, Abhay, thank you so much. Again, you have been my personal guru, my teacher. for many decades, and it's going to be many more decades in the future. No, you're incredible. You've changed ophthalmology worldwide, no question.
Thank you so very much once again, Uday, for this wonderful learning opportunity for me. And wish you all the best. And please continue this wonderful, wonderful education program that you've been putting globally for years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. They need such programs.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And remember, our listeners and viewers, we got a new Cataract Coach podcast every single Sunday. We have a new Cataract Coach video every single day, 2,700 videos in a row and counting. Remember, the podcast is on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you get a podcast, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. Plus, we also now have our sister channel, RetinaRounds.com, and RetinaRounds podcast too. So check it out. So until next time, I'll catch you later.